Well, thank you very much for inviting me to this conference. I think it's a very interesting program that you have put up. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with eGenetics, probably not so many. I will try to tell you a little bit of what we have learned of the from yeast genetics and from yeast genomics, what we have learned in terms of evolution and mechanism of evolution, which is, as I understand, is the topic of your conference. So, So I will divide this in two parts. One today, and Massimo was kind enough to give me another one to tomorrow. So we'll see. I will try today to give you more of the basics and some of the.
I understand you're so popular, you need more chairs.
There is one over there. I will try to give some of the basics and some of the general idea on how yeast work, because some people may not be so familiar with this type of thing. Now, I would like to put that into the context of population genetics and genomics, which is your title. When we think of principle of evolution, I think all of you and all of us have in aid the fact that with the number of generations, sequence diverge. Everybody knows that. Yeah. In fact, the number of generations are very numerous. I put here figures like thousands of billions, because this is actually what exists for yeast, thousands of billions of successive generations. We are not talking of small numbers, we are talking of huge numbers for sequence divergence. Sequence divergence is the final result of course, the accumulation of replication errors, which increase the genetic polymorphism, the number of alleles, and so, and the genetic drift and selection, which will tend to decrease the population, the number of alleles at any moment. And of course, every small equilibrium over thousands of generations makes the divergence of sequence that everybody is talking about. Just to give you a few figures, you probably have that in some of them in your head, at least for the vertebrates. As I have read, I think the mutation rate is of the order 10 to minus mutation per nucleotide per year. This is the clock. That means in the human genome, for example, there is roughly 3 mutations per genome per mitosis, considering that there is between 70 and 80 mitosis between two human generations. This is a total of something like 70-80 mutations between two human generations. And our intraspecific polymorphism is of the order of 1 in 1,000. If we apply this clock for human and chimps, for example, it fits relatively very well. We have 1.4 sequence divergence between chimpanzee and ourselves. And this is for something like 500,000 of generation of separation. Now, when we go to yeast, the clock is not as clear. First of all, the fossil records are extremely poor, so we don't have the dates exactly. The million years are not so clear. What we have is a precise figure of the mutation rate in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the baker's yeast. Precise figures of mutation rate, about 5 × 10⁻³ mutation per genome per mitosis, according to very recent data. The genome of yeast is about 200 times smaller compared to the genome of human. So in fact, if we go to the nucleotide level, the actual mutation rate is of the same order of magnitude, but there are less mutations because the genome is 200 times smaller. Intraspecific polymorphism in Saccharomyces cerevisiae population is of the order of 1.5%, which is already 15 times larger than when we have for human. This is what people call Saccharomyces cerevisiae strains or isolates that we can find in laboratories, in the wild, in bakeries, in breweries, and everywhere. Now, when we talk to closely related species, such as Saccharomyces cerevisiae, Saccharomyces bayanus, in every paper you will find them as very closely related. And in fact, they have their map is very very similar. Their maps are almost collinear. And they are close relative by this criterion, but they show about 20% sequence divergence, which is something 20 times larger than man and chimps, and which is about the same order as we have from mouse to human. Okay, this is what we have here. So the view of the sequence divergence in yeast has to be regarded with these figures compared to what we have for more familiar systems such as vertebrates. Now, what we've learned with yeast, that in addition to the sequence divergence, there is another dynamics.
Is yeast sort of phylogenetics well enough worked out, or just surveying? Are there new species?
I will tell you in a minute. There are new species described every day almost. Right now, we have. In the last edition of the book, it was about 700 species described. In the novel edition of the same book, it's 1400, and it keeps going rapidly. The problem is we don't know about the species. I'll tell you some of the details of that. So the second clock, which is going on in the evolution, is that genetic map rearrange. And in fact, we have studied that in yeast in some details, and this will be part of my talk today. In fact, genes duplicate, and I will tell you how they duplicate. In fact, genes never duplicate, but pieces of chromosomes duplicate. Okay. I will tell you, and this of course increases the genomic redundancy, the number of paralogs in genes. And this is in equilibrium with gene loss, which decreases the same redundancy. And again, this mechanism goes on and on for billions of generations. As a result, in vertebrates, for example, human genome, rat, mouse, we have about 65 or two-thirds of our genome is made of genes coding for proteins, which are themselves in members of more than two members families. Okay, 2% of our genome is coding for proteins. This is the figure. Of these proteins, about 2/3 of them are in multifamily members. For the yeast, the figures are here. This is a series of different yeasts. So you will see that about between 1/3 and 1/2 of the yeast proteins are also members of families. And in fact, I'm going to argue that the fact that proteins are in family is because at every single moment, the equilibrium between gene duplication and gene loss creates a certain number of genes which are in family. This is a building of the genome which makes family. And of course, this creates expansion of gene family as well as loss of gene, I will discuss in a minute. There's a third principle, which I'm not going to talk today, but I will discuss more tomorrow, is that we now see with yeast a series of mechanisms that create novel genes at any single moment. Lateral transfer, de novo gene formation of one kind or another. We increase the genomic originality, that means the number of new genes which exist in a species, which is not found in the other species. And of course, it's again balanced by gene loss. So I will discuss some of that tomorrow, not today. As a result, we have what we call orphan genes in all genome sequence so far, and we have the creation of novel sequence motif. So I will keep that for tomorrow. So the genomics of yeast actually started more than 10 years ago. This is a sequence of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. Now you have to realize Saccharomyces cerevisiae is a favorite model organism for genomics system biology. If you go to PubMed and say Saccharomyces cerevisiae, you will find over 80,000 publications. It is extremely well studied. Okay. By comparison, there are many other yeasts. As I have said, this is the status of genomics of yeast as of today. This is the species, about 25 of them. This is the species for which we have genome coverage, either full genome coverage or medium genome coverage. There's about two dozen or more than two dozens of them. Saccharomyces is here, Saccharomyces cerevisiae is here. A number of other yeasts are related to it. Saccharomyces bianus, the one I mentioned before, is here, and there is a number of others here. The phylogenetic tree here is based on calculation by Cletus Kurtmann and others, usually by the method of merging a series of polypeptide chains and calculating the tree by this way. Okay. Now, our own effort, we call them Genolevure Consortium, has produced these figures here. So we were the first to explore the complete so-called phylum or whatever, the complete phylum of Emiascomycete, okay, which is the name for this yeast. Others have done later. If we include that into the fungal genomics, there have been many other efforts in the world for fungus. Yeast Emiascomycetes are part of the ascomycetes, which are mycelium fungi. This is a number of names of the species for which we have also complete genome sequence, about 25 and others, or 30. So altogether, we have about more than 50 or 60 species of fungus, which can be used for comparative genomics or exploratory genomics or whatever. So this is the ascomycetes. Most of them are ascomycetes. Basidiomycetes are here. There are a number of other fungi here called zygomycetes, chytridiomycota, and so forth. Just I would like to insist on one thing. Those are the yeast, the budding yeast. Emiascomycetes are the budding yeast. The basidiomycetes are the mushroom that people collect in the forest, the more familiar figure. I should insist on the fact that yeast have been invented in evolution many times. There is one yeast here, which is part of the ascomycete, which is also quite heavily studied, Pseudosaccharomyces pombe. There's a number of studies on that. There are yeast here, Hippococcus neoformans, Malassezia globosa is the yeast growing on your head. If you have pieces of, this is because of Malassezia. So there are other yeast. So the fact that there are yeast that means single cell fungi has been invented recurrently over evolution. It's not a single phylum, but we have been studied ourselves. This group, which is clearly monophyletic, and originated from this filamentous fungi. Now the fungi themselves are not exactly monophyletic. In fact, as you probably know, fungi are not plants, despite what Department of Botany sometimes are telling. Fungi are not plants. Fungi are close to animals. They are split from animal branch at some point. And the way they are split from the animal branch is by loss of the flagellum. There was an interesting paper in Nature 2 years ago where one of the conclusions is a result indicates that there may be at least 4 independent losses of the flagellum in the kingdom fungi. So the view of that is the ancestor is a monocellular flagellated animal, and they have lost the flagellum at least 4 times separately, and creating the different fungal groups. Okay, this is the view that we have for the origin of fungi. By all criterion, fungi are clearly animals. They have the chitin. They have a number of signature which makes them close to the animal world and completely separated from the plant world. Okay. Now, before I go into the real talk. Why yeast? Because you may say, well, that's fine, but first of all, for the point today discussed in genomics, they are eukaryotes, and they have small and compact genomes, and of about 10 to 20 megabases. This is, of course, very convenient because you can have the sequence of that in a relatively simple manner. They are amenable to microbial techniques. This is very important. They form colonies, subclone, and so forth. This is very important for the development of genetics and so forth, because we can study them efficiently. As I've said, there is over 1,000 species described. We estimate that in nature there's probably 10 times more, maybe 100 times more, because when people look in the gut of insects, for example, they find yeast in that. And now the way they do the annotation of these yeast now is by sequencing pieces of rDNA or other genes, and they find many novel species never described. Okay. Yeast can form very large population. Yeast culture can go up to 10 to the 10, 11 or 12 cells per liter. Actually, a glass of beer, a live beer, is of this number of cells per liter, so just to give you an idea, which is very nice because we can select for rare mutants. And of course, yeast have been studied for years because of fermentation, and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, as I've said, has been a favored model. Yeast have been studied since early 18th century. This is Thomas Schwein, and he was the first to describe the yeast as Zucker pills in 1827. About 10, 12 years later, Mayen, another German biologist, gave the name Saccharomyces, which we are still using today. So just to give you, this is almost 100 years ago. And in fact, in the middle of the 19th century, Louis Pasteur, has done studies on yeast, because he wanted to study the spontaneous generation, the birth of organisms out of nothing. And in fact, he was studying the fermentation from sugar to ethanol, or from sugar to lactic acid, and he was the first to mention that the production of this fermentation are asymmetrical molecules, and therefore that the yeast which are found in the fermentation should be living organisms and not the product of fermentation, because the yeast should be the adjunct of fermentation, not the final product, because of this molecular asymmetry. So he was the first to really consider that yeast was a living organism. And a few years later, and we'll be all from a few years later, the big competitor of Louis Pasteur, Robert Koch in Germany, actually he was the one who invented the first petri dish. This is probably the first petri dish. This is a potato, half a potato. And as you can see here, he has started to plate. This is the yeast, which is a color red, called Rhodotorula something. And it has grown the yeast on the potato slice. It was almost to the point of making colonies. So you have to remember that in the middle of 19th century, there was no such thing as genetics. There was no such thing as colonies, subclone, and the like. Pasteur was working with liquid balls. Okay? And he did not have the idea to separate the cells one by one, making colonies. So it was a big change at the turn of the 19th century to be able to produce single cell colony, and because all the clone was, of course, easier. So as a result, yeast were at the origin of microbiology. You read the literature. They were also at the origin of enzymology, because by the same period, the butcher biochemist in Germany isolated the first enzyme, enzyme, this means yeast, yeah? Zymos is yeast. So, in the 20th century, just very quickly, yeast was used for cytology, genetics, molecular genetics, now genomics, and I will finish that, my history. Very few people know that the vacuole was discovered in early 90s by this group of people here looking at yeast in the microscope. So the cell organelle was discovered in the yeast. In the 50s, genetics started with F. Roussy, Lindegren, Hawthorne, Mortimer, and so forth. And this was more classical genetics, mapping genes and mutants. The first paper by Lindegren has six mutants. An interesting paper. First map of cerevisiae in nature. 1959, it has six mutants, six chromosomes, one gene per chromosome, and this is a genetic map. It's interesting. It's kind of interesting. When in 1989, when the sequence started, there was something like 700 genetic loci in this organism. Of course, yeast has been very important in molecular biology. In fact, there was a Nobel Prize for cell cycle to Lee Hartwell because it was one of the discoverers of the many genes involved in cell cycle regulation. Retrotransposons were discovered in yeast by Jeff Booker, 20 years ago, and so forth. And of course, genomics, I have just mentioned. Genomics started early 90 with a sequence of Cerevisiae, and we have now many of the yeast. So that's all for my recollection. I will just tell you one final idea before I go into the real topic, which is a surprise that we had about 4 years ago when we sequenced the first for other yeast besides Cerevisiae. The names are here. And we were comparing the proteins coded by Cerevisiae versus the homologs coded by Candida glabrata, Cluromachis lactis, or Debrayomyces anthonii, and Yarovia, and the like. And we were looking for the distribution of amino acid identity, making curves like this, as shown here. And I was interested to compare these curves. So that means, for example, Cerevisiae protein versus Candida glabrata. This is the blue curve here. So on the average, they have about 65% or so amino acid identity. Okay. And when we compare that to what other people were doing in chordates, for example, comparing man versus mouse or chicken or fishes or even the Sayona, this is the amino acid identity between man and mouse protein. The average is 90% or so. This is man and chicken. This is man and the two fishes. And this is man and the urochordate Sayona intestinalis. So I immediately realized that, in fact, a man and a fish gives a distribution of amino acid identity of orthologous protein, which are kind of similar to what we have for two yeast. Okay. So if I make this drawing, starting from Sarmes cerevisiae or starting from Homo sapiens, and comparing the other organisms and looking at the average or mode of the amino acid identity, you have figures like this. And in particular, what you see here is that species named Saccharomyces, as shown here, may be as divergent as chicken and a man. Species like Candida glabrata, which still belong to the same group as Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is more divergent than the fugu and other fishes, and so forth. And Yarovia lipolitica is even further from Cerevisiae than the urochordate are from the man. This is just to give you a broad idea that the yeast, despite the fact that they share the same name, and despite the fact that the names are sometimes quite confusing, they are extremely far apart. They are confusing because, for example, there is a Saccharomyces name, which is should be somewhere here, but they have been called Saccharomyces, and so forth. So if you take a Latin name, be careful where they are on the phylogenetic tree, because it's a problem. Yeah, so this is it. As a result of that, the view we have today of our Imiascomycetes, the budding yeast, is basically a group shown here. I will discuss the fact that the whole genome duplication has been clearly identified at this particular point. I will not discuss for lack of time, but I will discuss with you. Genetic code has changed here. This yeast here use a non-universal genetic code for one codon. Okay, only the CTG is not a leucine, it is a serine. It is not a big change, but it is a change big enough that if you want to overexpress or to want to express proteins of this yeast into this one or vice versa, it simply does not work. And in fact, what is important here is that in this group of yeast is one of the major human pathogens, Candida albicans, is right here. And this yeast is also very well studied. All of the others are very poorly studied. But this yeast is very well studied because it's one of the major human pathogens. And the proteins of Candida albicans cannot be expressed in Saccharomyces cerevisiae or in E. coli because of the change. Okay. I've written here major evolutionary divides. And the only figure I have for millions of years is from Berby and Taylor and from James et al. Two papers 2 years ago. One of them is based on the fact that there is a fossil. I told you the fossils are not extremely reliable. The oldest fungal fossil is 400 million years. This figure is reliable. But what is not reliable is assumed to be a sordariomycete. And for microscopic fossil are not so easy to characterize. It has received this name, Paleopyromycetes devonicus, okay? And according to that, and according to the phylogeny, and according to other calculations, we can extrapolate that this major divide is probably 100 to 300 million years old. And this one is something between 300 and 1,000 million years old, okay? This is the figure we have, which is not perfect, but gives you the idea that actually this is a very large evolutionary branch. The point I would like to make, and I will come back on that maybe tomorrow, is that despite, if you recalculate with this time, if you recalculate the number of generations, this is something between 100 and 1,000 billions of successive mitotic generations, assuming only one pair a day, but these grow faster than that. Okay, this is despite the fact that they are made this number of generations, their morphology and lifestyle is more or less the same. Just to remind that man and chimpanzees only half a million generations, or morphology is slightly different, lifestyle as well. And of course, in animals, separation of this date is something which is more than the sponges and ourselves or completely different organisms.
Isn't there some way of characterizing some functional divergence, precisely the similarity divergence of lifestyles based on some biochemical assay?
Well, the yeast are classified, the yeast are taken from a variety of places in nature or in human fermentation or whatever, and they are classified usually by the fact that they use different carbon sources, they produce different metabolites, they produce this type of amino acid or this type of amino acid. So this is all biochemistry, for the whole enzymology type, which is there. They are characterized by that. For example, these yeast here can use the alkane. Okay, they use alkane as carbon source. And these yeast do not do that. So they differ by some specific function. If you look in details, what is the reason? It's usually a small number of genes. They have a metabolic chain for something that the others do not have. Okay. The point, as you will see later on, is that there is a number of properties which have been either acquired or lost by the acquisition or loss of small number of genes. Okay. For example, this yeast here can grow in anaerobiosis. And in fact, we make wine with this one because it grows under in absence of oxygen. And the reason they grow under complete anaerobiosis is because they have inherited somewhere in this point by horizontal gene transfer, they have inherited a bacterial enzyme. So they have replaced the original ancestral eukaryotic enzyme and a bacterial type of enzyme. And therefore, these yeast do not grow under anaerobiosis. Number of things, this is a single gene.
Okay. But I guess maybe the question is there some way of quantifying the statement that the lifestyles are similar? Maybe if you were to ask a yeast, they would say that humans and Siona are very similar in lifestyle.
Yeah, I sort of agree. Our lifestyle and sheep's lifestyle are not so different after all. I sort of agree on that. They would consider themselves as different by. But for example, they are budding. They are developing by budding. They go through meiosis, diploid in a variety of fashion. But it is not related to the phylogeny. There's a whole variety of mating sex and loss and sex in the different branches. Okay, so they have a variety of ways of reproducing. What else can I tell you? If you are a yeast like this, the next step is to make two yeasts. Okay, and that's lifestyle.
Have the yeast ever come under extinction pressure?
Yeah, I think what happens here is that most of them, by far the vast majority of them, are extinct. And this is why we have a lot of trouble to find yeast which are clearly related. We don't have mammals ourselves, chimpanzees, cows, and whatever. We don't have that. We have, say, man, then we have a chicken, next one, and then we have a fish. So I think, as you might expect from microorganisms, they grow extremely fast. They develop by clonal growth. They lose sex most of the time. As soon as they can lose sex, they lose sex. Okay, and they grow only clonally. They expand clonally, and of course, most of them have to disappear, because otherwise we would be submerged by yeast everywhere. So it is not like, so most of them have to disappear, a very strong selection in the individual level. And this is probably why we have these big gaps everywhere.
Because there could be sufficient loss of information that may not be possible actually to relate.
It's a major difficulty that we do have. We know that those are clearly related. I will tell you for details, maybe I'll tell you tomorrow why we are sure that those are clearly related. We have a gap here. As usual, we have question marks near the gaps because there are yeast that we do not fit anywhere. We have inconsistent phylogenies at this point. And in fact, these gaps are extremely, extremely wide. We know that those go together. Again, we can demonstrate that. Those go together. How they are branched here? Yes. Something of question. Yeah. Okay, so now let me go to this. If you have never seen a yeast, this is a yeast, a mother cell, this is the bud. They grow by budding, this is a larger bud. The bud will, this is a mitosis, the bud will separate from the mother and will itself make a new yeast. Okay, this is the way they grow like this. Continuously, more or less exponentially. So I would like to go to my first point, which is the duplication of genes. I'd like to discuss the duplication and loss equilibrium. Of course, Suzumu Ono, 70, was the man who raised our attention to the fact that genes can duplicate, the evolutionary consequences of that. The original view, as you probably know better than I do, from one gene you make two. Again, this is a phenomenon which never exists. It's not a single gene that makes two, I will describe that, but you can make two copies out of a gene. And after mutational changes, one of the original has kept the original function and the other one has acquired new function. This is the basic of the model. In fact, we know that things are more complicated than that. Sometimes the two copies diverge, and the original function is lost, and it is separated between two new functions of the two new genes. We have cases like that. And in fact, the most frequent case, that one I'm discussing most, is that after duplication, one of the original copies retains the ancestral form, and the other one simply disappears again. And as a result, we have a single gene ancestor, a duplicated generation, and then the single gene progeny at the end. Okay, and this is extremely active process. So the evolution goes like this constantly, and therefore the gene in the progeny is inherited from the ancestor by a complicated duplication loss mechanism, and not by a direct, direct way. The problem is, if this path has been taken once in one of the ancestors, none of the two genes are identical to the to this one. And if you now you lose one of these two with this configuration, then you will be ending with a function here, which is not exactly identical to the function that goes here, because for some transient time there were two genes in the same cells. Okay, this is an important point to consider. Now, so the view is that a genome is only a snapshot of continuing processes of gene duplication loss during successive generation. I think you all know that. So the question we asked with yeast was not so much of the consequences of the duplication. Of course, people ask this question. But one of the questions we are interested in is, what is the mechanism by which gene can duplicate? What are the mechanisms that we know by which a gene can duplicate? Both people are convinced that gene can duplicate. In fact, if you look carefully, it is not so easy to duplicate a copy of a gene. I will just give you what I know are the mechanisms today. One of them is whole genome duplication. That means the genes do not duplicate, the genome duplicates, and therefore the gene which is inside is also duplicated. This is the formation of polyploid genomes, subsequently submitted to rearrangement and losses. I will describe that in some details. The second way to duplicate genes is to duplicate the piece of chromosome, what we call segmental duplication. A large chunk of chromosome gets duplicated, and therefore the genes which are inside are also duplicated. There is a third way, which I will not discuss today, but maybe tomorrow if I have time, which is tandem RS formation. Series of genes of the same nature are sitting next to each other, okay, creating a cluster. This is the only case in which a single gene is duplicated without its environment. The cases that everybody is talking about, in which a gene is duplicated and dispersed somewhere in the other part of the genome, is either the final result of one of these two, or, but this is after a very long time, or more frequently, it's only a retro gene. Genes can duplicate because they go through an RNA intermediate. The RNA goes there, of course, anywhere in ectopic position, and re-end in somewhere in the chromosome. We do have clear-cut cases in yeast of that, in which single gene or part of genes can duplicate that way. But single genes do not duplicate themselves, starting from one point of chromosome and jumping to another point of the chromosome on a DNA-based mechanism. We don't have such a mechanism, okay?
So does the yeast maintain the genes for the reverse transcription, or is the reverse transcription caused by...
The reverse transcription, I will tell you tomorrow, the reverse transcription is encoded by the retroposons, the class one elements retroposon called CY elements, so same as copia or gypsy in other organisms. So they are retro elements that code for the reverse transcriptase. The yeast use that. Okay. But not all of the yeast have retro elements because they tend to lose it. So in fact, and I will discuss that tomorrow, in fact, retro elements are in addition to the genome, and we see some cases in which they have been inserted by one mechanism or another, and they tend to disappear afterward. When the lineage is only clonal, if the yeast lose sex, they tend to lose the element as well. Therefore, they really lose the capacity of making cDNA copies. Okay, so they acquire the retrotransposon by mating, by sex. The retrotransposon spread in the genome, and if they stop sex, the retrotransposon will disappear. And they will go again back to the original state. Okay. So they can, when we have the retrotransposon, I will tell you tomorrow, we can make the genes move. We can engineer the retrotransposon and so that the gene will move in different places. Okay. So let me tell you something on whole genome duplication. First of all, a little bit of history. It was not discovered in yeast, but it was demonstrated in yeast. In the 60s, it was already known that some plants are polyploid hybrids. For example, corn has 4X or 6X chromosomes, depending on which corn you're talking about. This is a hybrid made by our ancestor. It does not exist in nature. In the 80s, there was a very provocative hypothesis called 2R hypothesis, based on a single gene, the fact that in man and most vertebrates, the OX gene cluster, a group of genes involved in development, there are four of them. Out of that, people hypothesized that the genome of vertebrate was made through two rounds of whole genome duplication. Okay, the fact is there were four genes. Those were duplicated. But people were hypothesizing that the genomes were made of two successive whole genome duplication, which is possible but not yet completely demonstrated. In fact, the first whole genome duplication suggested, was 1997 with the genome of Cerevisiae. And this genome shows dispersed pairs of what we call sister segments. I will show you the details of that in a minute. This is only 10 years ago. It was 7 years later that this hypothesis was clearly demonstrated by comparing the genome of this yeast versus another yeast and showing what we call dual synteny. And I will show you the details of that in a minute. And the same year, the fish tetranodon negroviridis, using the same basic principle as the yeast, demonstrated the duplication in the fish in addition to this one. And now we have many examples. The genome of Paramecium was published last year, and we have many examples of plants as of today. So in fact, we have examples of all genome duplication scattered throughout evolution. They are not everywhere. They are at specific points in evolution, the one which are clearly demonstrated. There may be others, but some of them are probably erased or something. But they are not everywhere. But they are very, very clear-cut examples at some specific points. So I will give you some examples there. My best example is not yeast, it's a Paramecium. Paramecium is a ciliate. And this is the genome of Paramecium tetraaurelia, in which the genome of Paramecium tetraaurelia has 49,000 genes, more than twice the human genome. And these authors last year, analyzed the sequence of this genome and shown that it is the result of at least three successive whole genome duplication which are still recognizable. For example, the 49,000 genes which are here, you will see this small curve here. This is not the chromosome, because what they have sequenced is the macronucleus, which is a fragmented form of the chromosome. Okay, but this is a piece of the sequence. And what you see here, and there's a series of genes in this piece here, which match with a series of genes on this piece, again here and again here, an almost perfect match. So they could hypothesize that the 49,000 genes originate from about 25,000 others, shown here. And if you draw the map of the possible ancestor, the same phenomenon again exists, suggesting for another ancestor with only 12,000 genes. And then they have been going further in the paper, assuming there's been another one here, starting from probably 6,000 genes. The last one is not very visible. The first one is extremely visible. Almost all of the genes are duplicated. Not all, but almost all. This is a unique case. We don't have cases in which the whole genome duplications give a genome with twice as many genes. Very, very rare. This is almost a unique case.
So there's very few loss of genes between these duplications.
For the last one, there are very few. There are slightly more here, okay, but not so many. There are many here, but this is a very ancestral one, okay? So the loss of gene for the last one is limited. Maybe, I don't know, 10-15%, something like that. As you will see, for most of the other cases, the loss of gene is extensive. Sometimes it's almost complete.
Are there relatives with the
25,000 genes? They have been looking for that. Again, it's a microbe, and they may have the same trouble as we have for yeast. It is not easy to find the relative. Maybe they are dead.
Do you believe that it's a fitness advantage to these duplications?
That's, of course, a possibility, or it is just a chance, because if you consider a series of, you know, continuous series of events, you may end up by chance finding the day when the thing happens, whether it is advantageous or not. From a single point, I will not extrapolate from a single point. We have that of today. Again, if we had another one, we could discuss of the advantage or not.
What is their attitude towards sex?
Oh yeah, they can grow, they have sex, but in a very complicated way. Well, I don't know if this seminar will last for long. The way they do that, the genome which is sequenced here is not the genome which has sex. The genome which has sex is called micronucleus. It's a small genome of 100 megabase, okay, which is the lineage from one generation to the next. They mate with another one. They make a diploid. They make meiosis. Okay. Once they have done that, the genome is stored in kind of fashion, and out of that, a macronucleus is amplified. This macronucleus is about 100 times larger than 100 copies compared to the micronucleus. But it is not a single copy. It is a copy of almost every gene except some specific parts which are deleted, okay, by a variety of fashion, in an intron-like fashion at the DNA level, if you wish. So in fact, the cell is living on a 100 copy or so of DNA, which are themselves copy of the initial genome, but the 100 copies do not have the complete set of sequences which are in the complete genome. Okay, what was sequenced here for technical reason is the macronucleus, because it's simply 100 times more abundant. That's what it is. We don't have yet the micronucleus, except for some specific genes.
Is there any sign of dealing
in this one, I would not tell. We have cases, clear-cut cases in yeast that I can document, but in this case, that's my ignorance. Maybe they have some, I don't know.
You made one remark that I found very interesting, so I'd like to make sure that I understood correctly. You said that one of the problems with finding relatives that are interestingly different is that if you go out in the wild and collect these guys, you typically get the ones you already know about.
Yeah. We get the ones which are extremely closely related to the one we know, or we get completely novel ones which are not related to the one we know. Okay, so we don't have the intermediate stage. Some cases, some of them are closer than others. We have the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, some of them are relatively close, so we can tell that, but not everywhere. So we have big gaps. Well, one of the issues, perhaps we have not been into the wild enough, because yeast live mostly on the trunk of trees, where there is some exudate, they can grow on that. They live artificially in the human fermentation, and they live in insect guts, mostly, or invertebrate guts, where they are transported by the insects, so they go all over the planet because the insects are flying, so the yeast are flying as well. So this is a major three niches of the yeast that we have. Okay. But when we collect yeast on the trunk of trees, they are of the known species. No. Okay, this is the whole genome duplication for the fish Tetraodon negrovirus. So, okay, same thing as for Paramecium. This is now the chromosomes, because they have the chromosome there. And you see that this chromosome has a bunch of genes in the same, nearly the same order as this chromosome, this one with this one, and this one with, and so forth. So you see a few rearrangements. You see a few inversions here and there. In fact, this is a total of about 500 gene pairs or something like that, compared to the about 20,000 genes that this fish has. So in this case, most of the post-duplicated genes have been again disappeared. Okay? They have retained about 500 or 600, I don't know exactly, pairs of genes compared to the original joint duplication. But because they are in the right order and conserve the synteny block, I think the argument is relatively good that the genome was duplicated. Genome duplication is placed here at the origin of this Actinopterygii species. The two R hypotheses are here at the origin of vertebrates. The interesting part again is that if we compare man, which is here, to this fish, man was not duplicated in this part versus this fish, and you see this 1-to-2 relationship. I don't know if you see it very well. What you call dual synteny relationship. That means for a tetraodon chromosome, for example 7, we have 2 matches with 2 human chromosomes. Same here, same here, so forth. You will have better details with yeast in a minute. So this 1-to-2 dual relationship is very important because even if the fish had lost all of its duplicated genes, that 1-to-2 relationship would still remain. Okay? This is a very important aspect to find a novel duplicated gene. So this is a case for yeast. Cerevisiae, it was published 10 years ago, that the Cerevisiae genome, this is Cerevisiae genome here, the chromosomes, and you see pieces, drawing is slightly different, but it is the same idea, pieces of chromosomes which are sister block series of genes of the same origin. When we look at one of these blocks, I don't know, for example, this one, what you will see is a figure like this. On one chromosome, you have this gene. On the other chromosome, you have this gene. These two go together. They are paralogs. These two go together. These two go together. None of the other go together. This is a result of the extensive gene loss which has occurred after the duplication. So the sister blocks are very difficult to find, and they are extremely erased. Okay, if deletion, if loss of this one have been occurred, then the sister block will be only these two. And if you lose these two, then you don't know whether there is a sister block. It's completely erased. Okay. The point is, the map of the gene creates a block on one chromosome, say yellow, another one on chromosome blue. These two genes originate from a common chromosomal ancestor. And we see that when we take another yeast, which is like man versus fish, this yeast was not duplicated here. And this is the order of this gene for this yeast. And when we compare this yeast with Cerevisiae, what you see here is this dual synteny, which is everywhere. In this case, the non-duplicated yeast is here, and it aligns perfectly well with the yellow chromosome of Cerevisiae on one side, and it aligns perfectly well with the blue chromosome of Cerevisiae on the other side. So there is a 1-to-2 relationship, and it doesn't matter if Cerevisiae has lost 100% of its original duplicates, because the dual synteny will still remain. Okay, so this is a very important signature that we to have. That means we have one species with a map like this, compare it to another species, and when we see a 1-to-2 syntonic relationship, it means the other species has, in the ancestry, had all genome duplication followed by almost complete gene loss. Okay? Yeah? No?
The remarkable thing here is really preservation of order.
Yes.
So are there examples when these chunks of order chunks have
been? It's a good question. In fact, I will tell you tomorrow, but gene order is relatively robust. Okay. Gene order can be changed because of chromosomal translocation, a few of them. Okay. But it takes extremely long time. So gene order is relatively robust. The fish tetraodon and man in the chunk of DNA sequence, they have the same gene order. We have the same gene order. Of course, there are some translocation here and there, but we have large synteny blocks. So gene order is relatively robust. The point is, when you want to change in order, either you make crossover or whatever, or translocation between chromosomes, but the pieces will remain in order. So you see the breaks here and there, but there are not so many of them, so the pieces remain in order. That's number one. What we see quite often is inside the block, we see locally genes which are inverted. So you see a couple of genes, two, three genes, four genes, change orientation. We don't know exactly how this is formed, but I have some guess pattern. Okay. But the overall order is preserved. So sometimes you will see a cross like this in the drawing based on this minor inversion. Okay.
But what does this imply about the insert? So for example,
this one here.
Still looking at the top one. Sorry.
Which one?
Yeah. So for example, between 2 and 14, there are all these blue genes. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So there's this kind of inserted block. So are they new or did,
no.
Did they come?
2, 3, 6, 7, 8, and so forth. They were there in the order of the ancestor. Okay. It's
very
only
that
three was lost here, 4 was lost here, 7 was lost here, and so forth. Okay. Okay. That's what happened.
Okay.
Some cases we find pseudogene. I have illustrated here a pseudogene. So the 5 is no longer a gene, but you see the traces of what used to be 5. Okay. We see a few cases like that, not many. Okay. So this dual relationship is very important. Now I should notice that the first consequence of all genome duplication is that the map is completely reshuffled, because you start from this order, and you end up with one piece of chromosome with this order and the other piece of chromosome with this order. If you want to do that with translocation and gene movement and so forth, it will take as many events as we have genes. In this particular case, it doesn't take anything. You just duplicate and lose the gene. Okay?
In the bottom half of that phylogeny, the order is 1 through 20, like you said?
Yeah.
All of them have.
Well, no, I've taken one example. If I take this one or this one, you may end up with say a breakage at this point or another point here. It's not exactly the same, but we have large pieces of conserved gene orders in this list here. I will tell you tomorrow exactly the size of this block. They are not enormous, because these yeasts are not so close from one another. If we take those yeasts which are close to one another, the blocks are almost 100% of the chromosome.
Okay. You might lose all the genes, but because you keep traits and you keep the order, that's why you might.
If you lose these 3, okay, if you lose these 2 here, this 14 here and this 19 here, there will be no link between those two sisters. But there will still be the link, the 1-2 link with the third chromosome. Yeah.
So does it look like it's basically a coin toss, which one is conserved, or is there some resistance that you get runs?
I will tell you in a minute. It looks more or less random, and it has a major evolutionary consequence. I will tell you in a minute. Okay. But it, so far as we know, it looks more or less random. Okay, consequences. Most people are talking of new function. In fact, when we look carefully, most of the in series visier of the 6,000 or so duplicated genes at the in the ancestor, we have about 500 of them which are still duplicated as of today. Okay, among these 500 pairs that normally now are called onologue according to Ono. We used to call them onologues, these pairs of paralogues. Okay, and these 500 onologues, in most cases, they do not diverge by function, but they diverge by transcriptional regulation. So one of them in turn on in oxygen, the other in absence of oxygen, and so on. We have a lot of variation in gene expression, not so much in gene function. We have a few cases of gene functional change, for example, the SIR2 protein is a part of the replication machinery and so forth. So we have few functional changes, but most of them are regulatory changes. Now there is another question in which I think most people do not think too much. The rapid loss of duplicated gene pairs create map reshuffling.
But how can you be so, are you sure about the function of all these genes to be able to say this?
Well, it depends what you call a the word function is poorly defined itself. Okay, they are interchangeable. For example, ISO1 cytochrome C, ISO2 cytochrome C. There are two cytochrome C. One is active in presence of oxygen, the other one is active in absence of oxygen. But there are two cytochrome C. This is a typical example. Yeah. So the yeast use one or the other, depending on the oxygen concentration.
The problem could be at the level of control of the genes rather than the genes themselves. Right? It could be epigenetic control.
Well, but it's a transcriptional regulation. There, it can be epigenetic in addition, but it doesn't change the idea that this is, both of them are, so far as we know, are cytochrome C. They carry electrons.
Right. Or some kind of transcription regulation has nothing to do with gene duplication. So gene duplication is happening in the background of functional consequences, which have nothing to do with gene duplication.
Yeah, but the point is. We have compared transcriptional map of different yeast species. For example, we have an extensive comparison of Candida glabrata versus Saccharomyces cerevisiae. The point is that two yeasts are too far apart, and comparing the regulation is not so easy to interpret. When we have these two duplicates, we know that they are the two isocytochrome C genes, for example, they are there, and they are not expressed in the same manner.
Okay. If they're really doing the exact same thing, these two genes, then is there really any point to having two?
Is this
just stochastic?
No, this is what people believe, why they can be lost, one or the other. Okay, but this is exactly the same thing. You will not lose ISO1, ISO2 cytochrome C as of today, because one is used in oxygen, the other in absence of oxygen. Therefore, both are necessary. Okay. So in this particular case, you're not able to lose them anymore. But before they changed the regulation, they were strictly identical.
So if you would predict that if you make a new kind of yeast that expresses one of the copies in both conditions, it could get rid of the other one, and it would do so because it would reduce the size of the genome.
Yeah. Yeah, genome size is probably one of the constraints, but they are also simply just accumulate mutations which are never clarified by any selective material.
Somehow that's hard to do then, because it didn't happen.
Both, there are two cases. Okay, it comes to the gene dosage. When you have two genes, strictly identical, the phenotype could be completely neutral, maybe the same as one gene, and you can lose one or the other randomly without any phenotypic difference. Okay, this is what happened. The other thing is that when you have two genes, the phenotype could be deleterious compared to one gene. And then there will be a positive selective pressure to lose one or the other. And we do have cases in which two genes are deleterious. Therefore, if you end up at one stage in a situation where you have two genes there, very quickly you will lose one or the other because there will be a pressure to do so. Okay? And you'll do the same thing for all of the genes elsewhere.
First estimates were sort of how fast the loss happens. So you just said that it's sort of consistent with just accumulated mutations. So
no, it is, as I will tell you in a minute, it is more consistent with gene deletion than accumulated mutation. So most of them are lost because the gene disappears for unknown mechanism.
Do we have any estimate how often that happens per generation?
Not exactly. I'd like to have one, but I don't have one. I will tell you in a minute afterwards. So the second point is, I would like to insist on that, because not so many people are familiar with that. In fact, take this example. The original duplication is here. Just remember for a minute these four names. Cerevisiae, you have already seen. Calactis, the one which is not duplicated. Candida glabrata, S. castelli, two other yeast. Okay, when the people compare, for example, this one with this one, the two closest one here, okay, you see that about, this is the genomes as they are today, This is the genome hypothesized at speciation, the genome hypothesized after duplication. So after duplication, there are 10,000 genes. They have lost most of them already in this part of the tree, or in this part of the tree. And then they have subsequently lost some of them in this branch, some of them in this branch, shown here, 150 lost here, 230 lost here, okay? So in fact, we have gene loss, lot of them, when you compare these three yeasts, a lot of loss have occurred here, some losses occur here, some losses occur here, and so forth, okay? Now there is a very significant consequence to that, that not so many people consider. Consider Pyromyces lactis. This is a gene order, okay? You map onto it the two copies of Escherichia. This is the gene order. You see the dual synteny, okay? In this particular case, this gene is still an homologue, you know, two pairs. There is one pair here. Or every one of them, of the others, are single gene, but they are two pairs. You just consider Candida castelli, the same region, same two dual synteny, except this gene has been lost, and here as well, so this is completely gone. And this gene, instead of being here, as in Cerevisiae, is on the other half, okay? And you consider now Candida glabrata, the last one here, and you will see this one is same as this one, but not as Cerevisiae. This one is also lost, and else, and I think that's it, and there are two copies here, yeah. No, sorry, there is only two copies for this, and only one copy for glabrata.
So you could make a hypothesis that gene duplication is relevant, but then yeah. There is strong pressure for loss of gene in that speciation.
Absolutely.
Is that a model for speciation?
Yes, but in addition to that, what happens here, the loss here has been what we call coincident. Therefore, because the three yeasts, yeah, which are here, have lost the same copy and kept the same one. So the loss has probably occurred actually here, yeah? We do have cases like this in which the loss is differential. For example, it was lost in this part here, but it was lost in this part here. Therefore, the loss have to take care here and here, okay? And we have more complex cases in which we have two to one, the loss has taken place clearly in this branch here, okay?
There could also be lost species that are not on your phylogeny.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is the following. We knew for years that the Saccharomyces sensu stricto, the one used for bread and beer and wine and so forth, are very often hybrids. In fact, people don't make beer with Saccharomyces cerevisiae, they make beer with Saccharomyces pastorianus. Pastorianus is a hybrid between cerevisiae and Paradoxus. Paradoxus is the closest relative to cerevisiae. Okay. They have about 10-15% nucleotide sequence divergence. So this is as if they were mouse and man. Okay, but this is the closest relative we have. You make beer with Pastorianus, which is a hybrid of these two. We knew for 100 years that the hybrids are sterile. Okay, and people knew that. And now we know why they are sterile. In fact, this is called the Dobzhansky-Müller-Batson incompatibility, which is the basics of genetics. Assume the ancestor is like this. Assume this is species one, Cerevisiae. Therefore, after the ancestor, it has lost here and here. And assume that in Paradoxus, it has lost these two copies. You make those two. The hybrid is perfectly okay. The hybrid has a complete set of genes. And it is nice to make beer. But if it undergoes meiosis, based on chromosomal rearrangement, some of the product will be like this, and others will be like this. This one is missing this gene. This one is missing this gene. So those two will be dead. You just reiterate this drawing for the 6,000 genes, and you will see that none of the progeny after meiosis will have a complete gene set. So they are all dead. Okay. As a result of that, the whole genome duplication followed by differential gene loss is a very strong mechanism to create species, because they can mate, they still mate, but the hybrids are no longer viable. So the species differentiation, there is species explosion here. After the genome duplication, gene loss, species will explode. And in fact, if you look at the fishes, it is very strange in the evolution of fishes. The fishes have exploded as well, probably in terms of species, in terms of variety of species, probably as a result of this additional duplication that they had. So in fact, this is a major speciation mechanism. Okay. So the yeast continues to diverge in terms of sequence. As I've said, these two are like man and mouse. The protein sequences are quite divergent. They can still mate. Actually, they mate much further. This one mate with this one. In fact, they mate with another one, which is 500 million years of separation. So they mate with everything they can find. So these two here mate. The hybrid is alive, but it cannot make meiosis anymore. Yeah.
So beer is made with
deponies? Beer is usually, well, depends on the company, but beer in Denmark, where it as it should be, is made with this kind of hybrid. Yes.
But this hybrid, I'm asking just to make sure I understood what you're saying. The hybrid is only viable as a diploid.
Yes, hybrid is viable, completely viable, but it does not sporulate anymore. Okay, and same is true for all kinds of. There are many hybrids in between all of these, including those, and none of them is okay. So I think this is a very important aspect of this. So what time is it?
Are there examples of hybrids then duplicating, because that would solve the problem, right? Like in plants sometimes.
I don't think it will solve the problem, because chromosomal segregation will still be random, and if the hybrid segregates chromosome irrespective of their parents, okay, some of the meiotic product will be devoid of gene.
But if there's a lot of sequence divergence, then maybe they would pair based on
gene. I think you are right. This is what I was thinking, that if you take, okay. The further are the two parents, the better it should be, okay? Because the two chromosomes should be identifiable. Okay? If you take your closest relative, then you are in trouble. Okay? We do have recent results suggesting that in fact many of those yeasts are in fact hybrid between distantly related species, and in this case they are fertile. Okay, but this is something which is not yet finished.
But if that is true, then the phylogeny is very hard to reconstruct.
Absolutely, and it is. you will see a lot of papers about that. Yes, phylogeny is a nightmare. We have done ourselves, because we have 6,000 genes, we have done 6,000 phylogenetic trees for 6,000 homologs. And 200 of them match in a congruent way. The other 500,000 and something, 5,000 different trees, some of which are minor details you can forget about, but many of them are completely. So the phylogenetic tree is a problem.
There is some time window, right? Because these guys have to, their common ancestor has to be after the duplication.
Yeah.
But shortly after the duplication, because otherwise all these loss events have already taken place, right? Because
Absolutely. Absolutely. It depends what is the ratio of loss, say, here versus here, okay? The one we have analyzed so far, most of the loss were common, and only a minority of the losses were species-specific. But maybe we don't have the others, that's maybe. Should we stop for 5 minutes here or whatever? Then I will go to another part. Okay, I would like in the last part to tell you of another mechanism, which is a segmental duplication. That means, in this case, not the whole genome is duplicated, but pieces of chromosomes, sometimes complete chromosomes, rarely, but species of Komodo. Now this is just a view of a paper. This is a rat genome, but it could be the same for human or whatever, in which the authors have described that there are pieces of segments of chromosomes here and there, always, everywhere, that are duplicated, either in tandem next to each other, sometimes slightly further apart, and sometimes in interchromosomal duplication, the one in red, the piece here duplicated here, and so forth. Altogether, it is written in literature that about 5 to 6% of our genome is made of such duplicates, the duplicate being defined as a segment with more than 90% sequence identity, which means according to this relatively recent parent, and more than 5 kilobases in length. Most of them are, in fact, 100 kilobases or 200 kilobases and so forth. Okay. This is a view of our genome. What we've done with yeast was to try to understand whether this thing exists and what is the mechanism that formed them. And these three people from my lab, shown here, have developed an assay from yeast. This is the yeast, bud. Typical here is a gene duplicated. This is an homologue, the two pairs of a ribosomal protein coding gene. Okay. And what they have done was to delete one of them, which is easy in yeast, you delete whatever you like. In this particular case, this was a strong gene. This was a minor gene. Again, same function, ribosomal protein. This one strongly expressed, this one poorly expressed. Okay. So if you delete the strong one, you get a severe phenotype. The yeast do not like it, and it grows very poorly. You see the tiny points here, and there are many of them everywhere. And they have a generation time, which is a disaster. And you see here colonies, which grow normally, appearing at a frequency of, we have been measuring that carefully, 10 to the minus 7 per cell per generation, which is very high. 10 to minus 7 is 1 in 10 million, but because there's so many yeast in a test tube, it's every test tube that you see here. And they have asked the question, what 10 to minus 7, what happens here, what happens in these colonies to make this colony grow normally when this gene has been properly deleted? Most people would have thought that the simplest thing is that this gene gets turned on efficiently, and the yeast will say, enough, I have enough material to grow, and this is it. And this has never happened. Instead, what they have discovered is that the large colonies were due to segmental duplication, spontaneous, large segment. Some of them were in tandem, as described in human, but this is now large pieces of chromosome, 40, 50, 200 kilobases, something like that. They have discovered that sometimes the duplication is on another chromosome, again, as in human. They have even discovered that sometimes two duplications take place, one here and one here, forming an additional chromosome. So here we have made a real evolution. We have 17 chromosomes in this yeast, except versus 16. So we have made a novel species according to this definition. So in the test tube, we have created a yeast with more chromosomes based on the copy of the two parts of the former one. Okay, the way it was characterized by classical molecular techniques, this is a DNA combing. Here you have a pieces of a DNA molecule lying on a glass slide, which is hybridized with probes, and you see the parent, that means the slow growing strain. You see the fast growing strain has two copies in tandem of this piece of DNA. This piece of DNA is 102 kilobases, but we have pieces ranging from 40 kilobases to about 400-500 kilobases. In another method that they have used is what we call pulse-field gel electrophoresis. The chromosomes of Cerevisiae can be separated in a pulse-field gradient. And you can see, this is the original strain, the slow-growing one. And you can see that in the fast-growing revertants, you find additional pieces of chromosomes migrating when they are characterized. You see the duplication of these chromosomes. And the final and probably the best way, best way until now, and now new sequencing is coming. It was what you call comparative genomic hybridization. You have microarrays with every genes everywhere, and you hybridize in a quantitative manner the revertants and compare to the original parent. And what you see, the duplicated segment on this chromosome, here duplicated segments here or here, and so forth. So we see very carefully the duplication. Nowadays, this was done a few years ago, we could sequence or thing with a novel sequencer and count the number of genes. Okay, so one point of attention. First of all, well, I would like to tell you these tandem duplications create the normal growth rate colonies. The gene which is the ribosomal gene is duplicated inside one of these blocks. So it is duplicated together with dozens of other flanking genes, okay, or here. Tandem arrays like this are relatively unstable. At next meiosis, they will cross over and loop out and return to the original form. But of course, then they will lose the rapid growth rate. Therefore, they will be back to the slow growth. Interchromosomal ones are extremely stable. They tend to stay forever. They don't almost do not lose at meiosis. Additional chromosomes are also unstable at meiosis. They segregate randomly during the meiotic spore, and they end up in one spore or the other. Okay. So one point I'd like to draw your attention is the fact that at the junction ignore gene limits. We have junction between genes, in gene, and so forth. So potentially, you have a method to create gene fusion. And in fact, remember that in many cases of cancer, such as leukemia, for example, many of the leukemia originate from gene fusion between, for example, a kinase and a transcription factor or something like that, which resembles a lot of what we see here.
This could be specific to yeast, which is short for one of the genes, right? So maybe it's not.
You will see in the next slide what we have found, yeah?
Are interchromosomal events as common as intra?
In the wild type, intrachromosomal events are slightly more common than inter in the wild type. But I will show you a couple of mutants in which we can reverse that. For example, out of 26 junction sequence, they found 13 chimera. Some of them were fusion in frame between known coding protein coding genes, so you can create a novel protein. Most of the case, I believe, it will be non-functional, but it may happen that it may be something. We have out-of-frame fusion, also a few cases, which may also be translated either out-of-frame or in the other frame. We have truncation, and we have fusion between sometimes between coding genes and, for example, non-coding RNA genes, tRNA, and so forth. All kind of fusion are possible. In human, because the genes are so much larger based on so many introns, it will be even easier to make gene fusion, because anything that will fuse in an intron will make a novel artificial gene. So that's what we have as a possibility. We have, this is already old, it's 4 years old, we have remarked or we have observed that the ends of these duplications coincide to replication termini. This is the replication map of the old chromosome of Cerevisiae as it was published almost 9 years ago. So now we have much better method, but this replication map of the time. And you see that the ends coincide more or less with the replication terminators, which are shown here. And or coincide with dispersed repeated sequences, such as the transposons, which are here and so forth. Okay. So this was the observation. Now what they have done recently was to use the power of genetics and to study the mechanism by creating that. The wild type strain, as I said, 10 to minus 7. This is a mutant this is a cyclin B mutant, a mutant for cell cycle. The cell cycle will be, the S phase will be elongated tremendously, late origin firing. You see that almost 1,000 times increase, not exactly, but 700 times increase in frequency of the same phenomenon. So if you extend the S phase, you will increase the frequency of segmental duplication by more than 2 logs, almost 3 logs. If you treat the cell with camptothecin, which is an inhibitor of topoisomerase, or with hydroxyurea, an inhibitor of ribonucleotide reductase, both of them will again elongate the S phase. You again, in particular case, will increase about 300 times. And if you change the nucleotide concentration, you will not change anything here. So from these experiments, we concluded that alteration of S phase increases frequency of spontaneous segmental duplication, more than 2 orders of magnitude, without changing the type distribution, intra versus interchromosomal, homologous versus non-homologous junction ends. Okay.
Does it also change whole chromosome duplication frequency?
We did not have enough cases. The extra chromosomal duplication, we did not have enough cases to tell. It doesn't seem different, but okay, we have less. This one is less frequent than the others.
So what is causing this? Segmental, is it meiotic, some kind of meiotic?
It's all meiotic. This is all meiotic.
No, it's meiotic, but it looks like meiosis, and if you have loss of heterozygosity.
No, I will tell you. Well, let me go on and we'll come back on that. The next mutant they have done was a series of mutants involved in, this is all jargon name for recombination and so forth. This is homologous recombination, recombination between homologous sequences. This is non-homologous unjoining, or recombination between two pieces of DNA of any sort. This is micro-homology mediated unjoining, recombination in two pieces of DNA with a little bit of sequence identity over a few nucleotides. So this is break-induced replication, which is the idea that you cut a piece of chromosome and this will initiate a replication fork, okay, and so forth. So they have done all of that. As you will see, the frequency is not so much different, a little bit, but nothing comparable to what we have before. But if you switch off homologous recombination, then you completely change the ratio of the ends. Then you don't see the transposon dispersed repeated sequences at the end anymore. So at this stage, they concluded that mutational alteration of homologous non-homologous repair pathway alters the type of distribution without significantly changing the frequency of events. Now, if you put that all together, they were proposing a model which is based as for, this is mitotic haploid cells. Okay, I should insist on that. If you assume two replication forks going like this during the S phase, in fact, each one is double because it goes like this, okay? And in fact, there's a number of arguments saying that it is not double, but they form into a replication factory and make a big loop, okay? This is how we view the replication shown here. This is the loop here. So the idea there is that based on the experiment on mutation, is that if one of the forks breaks at one point, and there are many reasons why one of the forks will break, because single strand break, for example, then they may have a chance to continue the replication by interacting with inside the replication factory with itself, or interacting with another replication factory. Okay, and this is what is shown here. So you start here again. Some of them will require homologous recombination. This is interaction between replication factory. So this part here will interact with the other replication factory in the other one.
Tumors do that a lot.
Yes.
And
in absence of homologous recombination, they will interact with themselves and do this type of thing. At the end, you will end up with this type of duplication. So this is the type of model that we have here. Which is reasonable in terms of what we have with the experiment, and which it simply means that there is a frequency quite high, 10 to minus 7, wild type, 10 to the minus 5 in the mutant, quite high frequency, to create such things, which are themselves a system for evolution, as or for disease, for gene changes or chromosome changes and so forth. So this is what we have for the segmental duplication. Then we ask the question, are they found in yeast naturally, when you don't do anything, because this thing has been done in the lab, in Saccharomyces cerevisiae?
Another question. Do yeast don't have apoptosis, right? They don't have.
Not
so in humans, this will be less.
Yes. Yeast do not have a complete apoptosis. But I will tell you tomorrow a phenomenon suggesting that they start the apoptosis and they stop. But they don't have a complete apoptosis. Actually, they don't need to have it. They just grow. So we have been asking the question whether in natural yeast, the one we have sequenced here, for example, whether we find duplicated segments or not. And we do find quite a number, except for this one. This one has no duplicated segment, or one. But otherwise, you find 30 to 60 or 70. They are relatively short size range, few kilo base. The point is that nearly all of them, except for some exception here, nearly all of them are in subtelomeric location, and few of them are internal to chromosomes. They are shown here. So in fact, the mechanism we have demonstrated with cerevisiae probably works as well for the other yeast. And as for cerevisiae, the internal chromosomal repeats are probably very unstable. Few of them are left, but not many. But the subtelomeric one, the transchromosomic one, are extremely stable, and we find a few dozens of them in the genome. Here is an example of that. This is Calactis again. Well, the way it is drawn is slightly strange. This is the telomeric ends. So the chromosome is here, and it goes like this. This is a telomere of chromosome A, B, C, D, the right arm of telomere, chromosome D, left of E, and so forth. And what this drawing is supposed to show you is that there are large pieces of sequences which are nearly identical or identical between the chromosome ends, which are exactly fits what is a segmental duplication left during the evolutionary time. So in fact, the mechanism is here. How important is it for real evolution inside the genome? Is debatable, but it is clearly important for the subtelomeric parts of the chromosome. Okay.
Are those active or are they silent?
That's a good question. Some of them, in cerevisiae, some of the subtelomeric regions are silent. Okay. In Lactis, it is not absolutely clear whether they are silent or not. Okay. So. I cannot really tell you this. Usually, the set of genes which are in the subtelomeric position is not completely random as well. They accumulate genes which are involved in cell-to-cell adhesion or cell-to-substrate adhesion. They involve a lot of accumulated genes like this, as well as they accumulate genes which are involved in recent selection. For example, we have humans have selected cerevisiae mutant without knowing that. And in fact, some of the genes used for the maltose utilization have been found in the nucleus, in the subtelomeric position of the nucleus.
Shouldn't this process reshuffle gene order?
Yeah.
You have these duplications, yeah. Moving pieces on the different chromosomes, and then
it will reshuffle gene order. Yeah.
But to the extent that we know that the gene order was, is conserved over
if you
a very long time,
don't have the impression it is not completely conserved. It is solid enough. Yeah.
But there seems to be somehow a constraint.
Yeah.
Like this is somehow saying that the new duplicate is more likely to be deleted than the old one.
That, again,
the rate is so high. And, but it's only in subtelomeric.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, in those areas, the order is completely messed up. If you compare cerevisiae and
the order in subtelomeric region.
Yes.
First of all, we don't have subtelomeric region sequence for all of the yeast. We have a few of them because it is kind of tough to sequence those things because the shotgun sequencing do not work based on this this duplication. So we have few examples, but the gene order are not conserved in subtelomeric position. Yeah, they are different.
Maybe I don't understand what subtelomeric means. So how long
are we doing? About it, in practice, it will be about 30 to maximum 50 kilobase. In practice, there is no strict limit of that. People use the definition, the first essential gene is no longer subtelomeric. In practice, it means 30 kilobase, something like that. It means usually a dozen of genes.
Was deleted, right? That study that you started, the discussion with?
Oh, it was internal. It was internal to the chromosome, the RPL 20.
The RPL, but...
It was in the chromosome arm, not in the subtelomeric position. Okay. Yes?
I'm confused. So therefore, these internal duplications occur with very high frequency also.
Yes, they occur with very high frequency. Here we are looking at nature, we are looking at what exists. Internal duplication occurs at high frequency in the test tube, and as I said, internal ones are not very stable. The transchromosomic ones are very stable. Transchromosomic ones almost always involve a telomere, okay? So they occur very efficiently, but they disappear again.
But interchromosomal duplications typically involve the subtelomeric
region. Yes, absolutely.
But the ones that stay,
yes,
you see. Are the ones that
subtelomeric. Most interchromosomal duplication that we have seen spontaneously, most of them go all the way to the subtelomere. Probably because, in fact, they start with a sort of break-induced replication type mechanism, which always go to the end. Yeah.
Okay, so it's not clear to me. Are you saying that the rate at which you get interchromosomal duplications into a telomere region is much higher than the ones you get internal, or are you saying the ones that you get internal are almost never fixed in the population?
The rate in wild type, we have about 2/3 internal, 1/3 transchromosomic, subtelomeric, okay, in wild type strain, okay? The 2/3 which are internal are extremely unstable, they go disappear. Okay? The 1/3 which is subtelomeric are much more stable. So at what you would expect that they are a minority when they are created, but they become the majority in a steady state because they are more stable.
Do you see them more often in yeast that are close to crisis or whatever the senescence? Or Is it known where in the cell cycle of the yeast?
No, we don't know that. It's a question we should look at. Yeast do not really senesce. The yeast buds until they bud in a circle like this, and they have a scar at every so the cell wall.
Netflix like limit. Right? You don't have a limit to how many.
They have almost no limit, but in fact they have one. The yeast mother cell will make a bud, and the bud will have a scar. The scar is irreversible. The next bud will be next to it, and next to it, and next to it, as a circle like this. When the whole surface of the cell wall is covered with bud, there is no space to bud anymore. Meanwhile, the mother cell has expanded because it just eat too much or whatever, so it becomes larger. So therefore, there is more cell wall created, and therefore it can expand the cell life. In practice, the yeast will bud about 20 to maximum 40 times, and then disappear. This is a large number of generation.
Well, that's fine, but the telomeric ends do get shortened.
Because the telomerase is active. The telomerase is active all the time. No, it's always on.
Nothing to do with loss of.
If you kill the telomerase, then you will shorten the lifespan. But in wild type, the telomerase is always active. Yeah.
So if you take your selected strain where it's duplicated and you're selected because of this RPL duplication, and you then delete the new copy of the RPL for an internal duplication, you predict that that would have lower fitness than the
They are returned to the lower fitness type. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But it would be even lower than the ancestor.
No, because it's same gene, same piece of chromosome, same everything. No, why should it be lower?
Not reverting the whole duplication, but just
Oh, deleting that single gene, it's, we have not done that. We have not done that exactly, so I cannot tell you.
That would basically tell you sort of the fitness effect.
What we have done is the opposite. We have replaced that gene by the wild type copy. So therefore, the yeast can lose the piece without becoming sick again, because it's now free to do whatever it likes. Okay, this is what we have done, but we have not done the opposite.
I remember a long time ago talking to Mark Johnson, who's a geneticist. He was showing me just like everything that was known about the pathway involving sugar metabolism.
Oh, yeah.
And he was pointing out to me that many of the duplicated genes, these maybe adaptive duplications,
yeah, absolutely,
are all in these telomeric regions. They jump across chromosomes,
absolutely,
consistent with this.
Yeah.
Nursing,
yeah.
But,
it's consistent with this idea.
Ones that actually get kind of permanently encoded in the species, those may be adaptive.
Yeah, we have a clear-cut case of the maltose utilizing genes have been rebuilt over the whole evolutionary history by Ken Wolf, and they appear as if they have been gradually moved to the telomeric position, as if there is a force to merge them to a telomeric position. Yeah.
Anyway, these occur, but whether they actually get fixed, maybe depending on what actually gets captured, and maybe just like your example of knocking out one of the homologs and then selecting for duplication in this case may actually have
Value
in sugar metabolism.
Yeah, well, Mark will do that. We are collaborating with him, so. Okay. If you want to stop before the other circle, I would like just to finish with gene loss, because you have to counterbalance duplication, otherwise genome will expand. Okay, and here's examples. Gene loss, people don't like it, because usually they consider it will make a deleterious mutation, which is not exactly as it is. This is more flexible than that. Here's an example of a yeast which has undergone what we call reductive evolution. It has lost many of the genes for sugar catabolism. Candida glabrata is a human pathogen. Okay, the name is misleading. It should be called Saccharomyces glabrata, but okay, it's because the medical doctor likes to call everything Candida, so it is Saccharomyces glabrata. it is of this branch. It has lost all sugar metabolism, galactose utilizing. Sucrose utilizing and so forth. It has lost pyridoxine metabolism, as shown here. Phosphate, a lot of phosphate import, phosphate transport. Allantoin metabolism and other sulfur and so forth, transporter and other. So it has undergone an evolution by gene loss such that it has lost function, which is quite frequent for pathogen. Pathogen are in fact adapted to their host, and they lose variety of things. What I would like to suggest here is that gene loss is quite often recurrent. So here again the tree. I should insist that most of the introns were already lost here, but we'll see that tomorrow. Glabrata is this one here, okay, and it has lost galactose utilizing gene as shown here. But the same 1, 2, 3, 4, another 5 genes have been lost independently in this branch and independently in this branch. So the loss of a function is a recurrent phenomenon. It may happen again and again in a similar fashion, independently from one and the other. Another aspect is that nicotinic acid biosynthesis, the niacin pathway, has been lost here, so it is absent for this and this. It has been lost independently here and so forth. And I would like to draw your attention to this one here, because in this particular case, losing a pathway, you gain a function. And most people are not very familiar with that. So, and it was published by the group of Cormac a few years ago. Again, Candida glabrata in urinary tract infection. It is known that in this group of yeast, expression of subtelomeric genes depends on NADP concentration, which is involved for the acetylation of the histone. Okay. When the NAD plus concentration is high in the cell, subtelomeric genes are silenced. In the subtelomeric genes are genes called EPA, which are adhesion epithelium adhesion genes. Okay, this is cell, this is proteins which will make the cell adhere to epithelium in your entire tract. So the phenotype of that is that the cell do not adhere to epithelium. When the NAD concentration is low, these genes are expressed and the cell will adhere to the epithelium. Now, NAD concentration is not something you can play with definitely because it's a very central metabolic coenzyme. NAD is made out of a long biosynthetic chain out of nicotinic acid. Nicotinic acid being itself either imported by permeases, and we have several permeases, which we have characterized. Some of them are high concentration, others are low concentration. Or it can be synthesized de novo by a series of genes called DAL genes, which are here, from general metabolism, creating nicotinic acid. Of course, you cannot make mutant here because you are dead. NAD plus, no way. Okay, you can make mutant here. It will grow on that, or you can make mutant here, so long as you provide the food and the NAD plus, okay? And what has happened in the nacazeomyces, the Candida glabrata is a nacazeomyces, what happened here compared to Cerevisiae, that it has lost the gene which are here. Therefore, this yeast can only grow through the permease and nicotinic acid. And what happened here is that the concentration of NAD plus in the cell will depend on the concentration of nicotinic acid in the medium. Okay, and as a result, when the cell goes into a low concentration of nicotinic acid, such as in urine tract, the NAD plus will be lower. The gene will be expressed and the cell will adhere to the epithelium. So I think it's an interesting example of an adaptation of a pathogen which use a normal environment, not by creating additional function, by losing function such that you will be dependent directly on your environment without creating anything. So you just create a novel phenotype. Here you adhere to the epithelium just because you have removed those genes here. And you don't have the synthesis of it. But I think it's an interesting example to contemplate because this is probably one of the most frequent method by which pathogen becomes pathogen. Because they don't have to invent anything. They just use the system as it is, just make it different. Okay. To finally, what are the mechanisms of gene loss? It was already asked. As I have told you, most cases, what we have from the Saccharomyces sensu stricto, when we have compared before, in most cases we have clean gene deletion. We don't know how it works. Sometimes it's, most cases it's one gene, sometimes it's a couple of two or three genes next to each other. We have no idea how it works. We don't have frequent cases in which half of the gene is deleted. There may be some, but in most cases it's clean deletion between two genes. This is relatively frequent, at least on evolutionary terms. As I have said, Cerevisiae has lost 90% of its analog. Candida glabrata has lost 95% of its analog, most of them through this mechanism. The other mechanism, which is of course possible, is that mutational decay will form pseudogenes. This gene will, the trace will be there, but the gene will be non-active. We have a few cases like this. We have screened all of the genome of yeast. It is less than a few percent of the gene. So it is not a frequent case. Possibly because of the selective pressure to have the genome as short as possible. And therefore, this is better than that. Because there is nothing here other than pseudogene here. Maybe there is selective pressure there. But we need to find some kind of deletion mechanism which are clean enough to end up with this situation. Okay, that's Just to finish, I think the gene not.
So can't you just have that there are deletion events that take out a chunk of 100, 200 base pairs?
It could be, but what we would like to understand by which mechanism you know that this is a piece that you want to delete. Because if you delete randomly, you will end up deleting next gene as frequently as you delete the proper one. So it. Yeah, it would be selected against, but maybe there is a more clever way, which is the only way the cell knows when where is a gene is when it is transcribed. Okay, otherwise the cell doesn't know where is a gene, basically, or signatures are weak. So maybe there is something there which tells the deletion mechanism, this part is not transcribed enough. Put it away, or something like that. Maybe it's not only a trial and error. Maybe it's something more more clever than that.
But if you look at spontaneous deletions just from polymorphism data in fruit fly, you know, then you see the typical insertion or deletion is just one base, two base, little, you know, four base, repeat a base, become six bases. Up to maybe 30 or 40 bases where you can see a little adjacency. And then it jumps to things like transposable elements or, you know, very large sizes. So, I mean, I suppose it's possible that you just nibble away by small deletions and selection favoring them. But you see the same thing in Rhabdopsis, the plant. There's a lot of polymorphism for presence and absence of genes, like in disease resistance genes, where a susceptible allele will just be the deletion of the whole gene. And there's so many examples that are clean, just the whole locus.
Absolutely.
These are polymorphisms, and so it does beg the question whether on that short time scale, whether there is some clean deletion mechanism of a whole.
And so, well, selection for microorganisms, selection is of course very strong, so you can have a lot of failures and it still works. For plants, the failure rate has to be lower because the progeny is not so abundant. So let me just illustrate one case in human, which is 2 years ago, a couple of papers in which people were doing SNP genotyping of parent offspring trios and compared to CGH dialing array and so on. And they found three papers 2 years ago. In one, they find over 500 regions of deletion in the child compared to the parents. Another one, another 500. Deletion of child compared to the parent, and this one, slightly different method, they use find only 100 deletion. They appeared simultaneously, I think, in Nature and Nature Genetics. The result of that, in the human population, each of us is hemizygous for something between 30 to 50 deletions, larger than 5 kilobase, and each of us is missing about 500 or 700 kilobase of DNA. This is the conclusion from this. It was a large series of trios, child versus the two parents trio, and going to this conclusion. So in fact, gene deletion in mammals or in primates is also quite frequent. In most cases, it has no phenotype. The child were perfectly fit, they are perfectly okay. In some cases, unfortunately, just have a phenotype, strong or weak, depends where you are. But we have to consider that deletions of genes is something which is not rare. We don't have the exact rate of deletions of genes, clean deletions of genes in yeast. I would love to have that, but I don't have that.
So can you say something about this? What pathways are they in? Are they genes that have overloads on?
What, this one here?
Yeah, so
this one here looks at apparently random, from what I read in this case. In this particular case, 100 of them out of 500 were already in homozygous state. That means they completely lost the complete region, not in hemizygous state. Okay. This is not big chunks. This is 1 to 700 kilobase, which for human genome is few genes. Okay. Same here and same here. This is the number of genes they have here. So this is species of each one is missing few genes here and there. I have not seen anything specific. I assume that if you lose a gene which is lethal, you will not have to do the experiment because there will be no child. So assume it will be as.
And this is not sequencing error.
No. This is no. This is tip snip. This is deletion. This is snip genotyping to characterize the deletion, where the deletion come from. Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
Okay.
So the
homozygous
ones are
hotspots
for deletion?
I'm not, I should read the results, but I don't know.
But we are presumably
particularly abundant for junk DNA, right? Yeah. Yeah, I don't think this will go as high as that, because most of that is probably looping out between the LTR or the ALU sequences, or all of that. We have 1.1 million. ALU sequences everywhere. This is what's for deletion.
Was it across all chromosomes or across some specific ones?
This was all genome wide.
There was no selection for a particular.
No, this was genome wide. Yeah.
And no ends of chromosomes.
No chromosome locations. Okay. So conclusion here. I have tried to explain you that gene duplication, gene loss create genome redundancy, increase, decrease, and so forth. We have two node mechanisms, whole genome duplication, segmental duplication, compensated by gene loss. This one is so far is relatively rare, a sort of catastrophic event, results in map reshuffling, explosion of speciation. This one is very frequent, but it is unstable, therefore it creates and go. Except for the subtelomeric region and the possibility to form chimeric genes. And gene loss is very frequent by deletion or mutational decay and may end up with function loss or function acquisition, actually. So as a result, all genomes are redundant. Most similar genomes are not, and most similar genes are not necessarily orthologous. I would like to finish on that. This is a redundancy, overall redundancy of the yeast. You see that these yeasts here, which are not, these are all genome duplication. These one are not, these one are not. You see that the overall ratio of duplicate gene is such that the overall genome redundancy is about 1.25. This is the number of genes divided by the number of gene types, basically. So an average of 125, slightly more when they have the whole genome duplication, slightly more, but not 250 because of the secondary gene loss. Yeah. Slightly more here as well for other reasons I will talk tomorrow, gene family expansion, specific gene family expansion are very active in this particular yeast. And I would like to finish by my, what are orthologous genes, which is a major discussion in evolution. People call orthologous genes quite often genes which are either unique between two species and therefore go together, or the most similar sequences between two species. And I would like to make this thinking of, if we have a dynamic duplication loss constantly, the orthologous relationship is a problem. Just here, if you have a duplication, a second one makes three gene copy in this ancestor. In this species, the two gene copies, and this one has lost, so two gene copies. In this species, the two are lost, this one is here. So now you compare these two. This is what we have as data. And we say that A1 and C1 are paralogous. This is no problem, of course, because it's easy to find. But we also say that B2 will be regarded as orthologous to A1, okay? But it could be orthologous to C1, who knows, okay? Depending on the in reality, B2 is a progeny of this triplicated gene, which is here. And if differentiation of function has taken place at this point, you don't know which one is orthologous to one. In fact, just to with the yeast, we can do slightly better because the genetic map being reasonably conserved, we can tell whether B2 is at the same position at it was in the original construct or not. So we can tell which one is orthologous based on the fact that they have not moved in the chromosome. Okay, so we do slightly better than that. But that's all we have. And I think it's an important issue because you read in the literature that genes are orthologous everywhere. You read that everywhere. People consider genes are orthologous, orthologous function, orthologous gene. But if the duplication loss, duplication loss is extensive, the orthology between distantly related organisms is probably an illusion rather than the real fact. Yeah.
Isn't this a little bit at odds with everything that you told us so far, where you say you can really line up these chromosomes and you get the symphony of...
Oh, you will see tomorrow. I tell you, we can line pieces of chromosome, for sure, in some yeast. Not in all. If I take Yarrobia lipolytica S. revisii, I will not line anything. There is no blocks conserved. For some subgroups of yeast, I can line pieces of chromosome. And in this case, I can tell which one is orthologous to what.
But then you must be able to give some sort of order of magnitudes of what fraction of the cases. When you do something simple as what everybody does and say, let's take best reciprocal hits to be orthologs.
Yeah.
What fraction of the time?
Yeah. We should quantify that,
right.
Which we actually we could do that, but I cannot answer that right now. But we should quantify that for the yeast species. When we do the same thing for the same species, how many times we are not correct? I know specific examples in which the best BDBH, the best are not the true orthologs. I know specific example of that. I don't have a complete quantification of that, but you are right.
So the random loss of the A and the B, that can really only happen if the division of the A and the B was not very long before the speciation, because otherwise they would be different genes. I mean, so in your diagram there, right,
You
retained A and B until the speciation.
Yeah.
So that presumably means that either that's a very short distance or else it's a long distance, but those A and B have gained different functions. So
it could be a distance between this and this could be quite a long distance.
So, well, if it's a long distance, then that suggests that A and B have gained different functions.
Could be, yeah.
In which case, then you're not going to get random loss later on when they separate, right?
Well, it depends what is different function, to which point they are different, to which point each one is essential.
So I'm thinking that can happen the way you've drawn it if that distance is short.
Well, again, if A and B and C becomes essential at this point, none of them will be lost. Okay, if they become essential at this point, but we have very few essential genes. Most of them can be lost actually by deletion artificially. So I think the distance here can be relatively large before A, B, and C, each one of them becomes essential for life. So it's a long evolutionary distance here between these two. So the A and B and C will be in sequence diverge, but not necessarily functionally diverge significantly. Okay, so then one of them can be lost or the other. Yeah.
Well, you showed us that there is about a 30% redundancy. So if we take a very simple interpretation of that and say one in three genes, there will be a redundant paralog in the genome.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so then there is some chance that this event will happen because you can lose one of the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I agree we should quantify that because the data we have now with the map comparison tell us, because we have long pieces of maps in which the genes order are conserved, therefore it is very unlikely that the genes are not at the common the distance,
right,
because they are at the appropriate position. So we can quantify that.
You mentioned this formation of chimeric genes by segmental duplications. In fact, I wonder why it should not occur even more frequently by whole gene duplication because of this huge redundancy that you potentially
because
every second gene is redundant, so you could imagine to have it.
Yeah, but the point is. Yeah, but you want to have a mechanism that creates breakpoints, and all genome duplication do not create easily break points unless for the deletion mechanism, but the deletion mechanism looks clean. So all genome duplication by itself do not create breakpoint, where the segmental duplication create breakpoints at the two ends of the segment. Okay, so this is why it does not exactly the same. Yeah. But I agree that other duplicates, from the whole genome duplicate, if you delete one gene, you may end up with fusing the two other genes. That's another possibility. Okay. But there is no, it is not built in the, when segmental duplication, it is built in the mechanism that it ignores the gene boundaries. Therefore, it will create fusion. Yeah?
So if you look at the data in different yeast, do you see any evidence of this accretion?
Yes, we have looked at that extensively. Actually, Pascal Durance from Bordeaux has done an extensive analysis of that, and there will be a paper appearing shortly, or maybe it's out already. He has looked at all of these yeasts, plus a few other fungi, and many of the accretion, well, it's a complicated story. Many of the accretion which are fungal specific. That means two pieces of genes corresponding to two genes in bacteria, for example, are fused and they are fungal specific. They have been fused forever. We do have other cases in which fusion is valid in one branch, not the other, or vice versa, and so forth. So he has a complete analysis of this sort of thing. Most of the accretion, functional accretion, compared to bacteria, they are universal to the fungal world, most of them. But we do have specific cases, specific on one branch, not the other, and so on and so forth. Yeah. Thank you. Tomorrow I will try to tell you some of the surprise and paradoxes and try to have some of my view on how novel genes might be created, if possible.